is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation. Rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
It's Tuesday, the 26th. Glad to have you here, 6 minutes past the hour. While CNN and other networks and newspapers are issuing retractions and firing reporters for creating fictitious stories about Donald Trump and connections to Russia and so forth, one news operation has been quietly gaining momentum, it appears to me, in putting out quality stories that have begun to get a lot of attention. Circa News, Circa as a broadcasting entity, owns local television stations. They also have an online presence now, circa.com. The television stations they own reach more than 40% of the local markets in America now. Their acquisition mode continues. But here's the headline that got my attention. Did the FBI retaliate against Michael Flynn by launching the Russia probe? You know, while everything about Russia and the collusion has proven to show that there's not one piece of evidence, there is exactly not one piece of evidence showing collusion between Donald Trump or his people with Russia in a run-up to the election in an effort to affect the outcome of the election against Hillary Clinton in November. But there do seem to be other concerns and questions, and that's why this Circa story is so fascinating. The FBI launched a criminal probe against Donald Trump, it reads, former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn 2 years after the retired Army General roiled the Bureau's leadership by intervening on behalf of a decorated counterterrorism agent who accused now Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe and other top officials of sexual discrimination, according to documents and interviews obtained by Circa. Flynn's intervention on behalf of Supervisory Special Agent Robin Gritz was highly unusual and included a letter in 2014 on his official Pentagon stationery, a public interview in 2015 supporting Gritz's case, and an offer to testify on her behalf. His offer put him as a hostile witness in a case against McCabe, who was soaring through the Bureau's leadership ranks. The FBI sought to block Flynn's support for the agent, asking a federal administrative law judge in May 2014 to keep General Michael Flynn and others from becoming a witness in her Equal Employment Opportunity Commission case. Memos obtained by Circa verify this. 2 years later, the FBI opened its inquiry into Flynn. The EEOC case, which is still pending, was serious enough to require McCabe to submit a sworn statement to investigators. That, according to documents also seen by Circa. The deputy director's testimony provided some of the strongest evidence in the case of possible retaliation because he admitted the FBI opened an internal investigation into Gritz's personal conduct after learning the agent had filed or intended to file a sex discrimination complaint against her supervisors. This is big. Make no mistake, this is big, and this is good work on behalf of Circa. McCabe eventually became the Bureau's number two executive and emerged as a central player in the FBI's Russia election tampering investigation, putting him in a position to impact the criminal inquiry against Flynn. Three FBI employees told Circa they personally witnessed McCabe make disparaging remarks about General Michael Flynn before and during the time the retired Army general emerged as a figure in the Russia case. Any red flags flying for you yet? The Bureau employees, who spoke only on condition of anonymity for fear of retribution, said they did not know the reason for McCabe's displeasure with Flynn, but that it made them uncomfortable as the Russia probe began to unfold and pressure built to investigate Flynn. One employee even consulted a private attorney. As far as the troops in the field, the vast majority were disgusted with the Russia decision, But that was McCabe driving the result that eventually led former FBI Director James Comey to make the decision. That coming from a senior federal law enforcement official with direct knowledge of the investigation. FBI agents' concerns became more pronounced when a highly classified piece of evidence, an intercepted conversation between Flynn and Russia's soon-to-be former ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, suddenly leaked to the news media and prompted Flynn's resignation as Trump's top security advisor. The Flynn leaks were nothing short of political, one FBI employee said to Circa, noting that the specific contents of the conversation were known only by a handful of government officials when they leaked. The leaks appear to be targeted to take Flynn out, which of course they did. Eventually, the probe on Flynn moved beyond Russia to question about whether he properly disclosed foreign payments affecting his security clearance. FBI officials declined to answer any questions from Circa, including whether McCabe ever considered recusing himself or has recused himself from the Flynn aspects of the Russian probe. McCabe also declined comment via the FBI press office. But one of the FBI's most famous whistleblowers says McCabe has an ethical obligation to recuse himself in the Flynn probe to avoid the appearance of retribution or bias. It might be a bit late for that. I don't think they have any choice but for him to step aside. So said Frederick Whitehurst, an FBI special agent and forensic chemist, blew the whistle on misdeeds inside the FBI crime lab 2 decades ago and prompted widespread reforms. Whitehurst said he saw senior FBI officials, including then-director Louis Freeh and then-counsel Howard Shapiro, recuse themselves in the 1990s from his whistleblowing case to avoid looking like they were involved. Documents and memos obtained by Circa detail how Flynn and other top officials at the government agencies in 2014 and 2015 came to interview in the EEOC case of Gritz, who rose over 2 decades to a supervisory special agent inside the FBI. This might be the biggest story in the Russia probe yet. Let's go to the hotline. Matt checking in from Okemos. Matt, what's on your mind?
Circa News is coming out with fact-based reporting, unlike the other news agencies. I wanted to say that they were so busy spying on Trump that pretty much they didn't protect us from foreign and surveillance, foreign intrusion. So they're partially colluding with Russia when they're so domestically spying on Trump. In other words, they dropped the ball.
I don't disagree with that. If they spend all their time looking into one thing, it becomes problematic in other areas. Matt, thank you for checking in. Circa News, Matt makes a good point there. Fact-based reporting. By the way, today, Cheryl Atkinson's new book, I think it's called Smear, comes out. Cheryl Atkinson dismissed from CBS News because she was doing too good of a job as an investigative reporter, actually asking questions, getting independent verification, making sure her sources were credible, vetting the people that she talked to, vetting the stories she presented. There's a lot of things to say about the current state of news and the affair of news in this world today. Cheryl Atkinson's book, Smear. Look for it today. It'd be a good read, I would guess. I'm going to read it. You should. It's 14 after on this Tuesday. Glad to have you along for the conversation. You can find out more, by the way, at that story, circa.com. It's the Steve Gruber Show. I'll be right back.
The Steve Gruber Show. American values with Midwestern common sense.
Scott tissue that I wish you saw. Sock after Mr. Know-it-all. I'll close your eyes and I'll kiss you, cause with the birds I'll share.
Going a different direction for a moment or two now. Up to $455,000 in grants are now available for Michigan-based organizations that are willing to try a new, what some say is a proven approach to tackling the national opioid crisis. In April, the Blue Cross Foundation granted $75,000 to a University of Michigan doctor and pharmacist collaborative that will serve about 50 patients. Dr. Pooja Lagacetti, lead investigator for the study, said the goal is to learn whether a specialized pharmacist at a UM primary care clinic, the East Ann Arbor Health Clinic, can help primary care doctors and their patients better manage chronic pain among patients who take what is termed risky levels of opioids. Dr. Pooja Lagacetti, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. All right, so This opioid crisis across America has become front page news in recent months. It has been going on for a very long time, and it continues to expand. It's over the counter, it's prescription medication as well as illegal drugs on the street corner, all of these things contributing to the crisis. How is this program different?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking it. I think the key here is, I'm a primary care physician and a researcher at the University of Michigan, and one of the things that I've noticed with my patients is exactly what you just described, that the opioid epidemic spans patients that are taking prescription drugs for, you know, chronic lower back pain or an injury that they had 20 years ago, to others that have, you know, converted over to street drugs and are using using street heroin to get a high. And so I think, you know, sometimes we loop all of these patients into one big bucket, but they're very different. And this intervention that we're proposing really is focused on those patients that primary care doctors see that probably aren't prescription drugs for chronic pain, maybe don't even view themselves as having an opioid use disorder, and are taking what evidence has shown to be risky amounts. So, you know, really high doses, they're taking other medications that can be dangerous in combination, stuff like benzodiazepines along with opioids. And we're essentially using a clinical pharmacist, so a pharmacist that would meet the patients in person during a visit for 30 minutes, who would help them better manage their pain medications and provide advice to the doctors on how to safely prescribe these medications.
Let me ask you this, doctor. At what point after an injury, you mentioned here a moment ago, injuries from some time ago that they're still medicating themselves for, how long is it before it becomes inappropriate for a doctor to continue to fill these prescriptions? I mean, is it a year? Is it 5 years? Where's the cutoff point? Because at some point, you're physically and emotionally addicted to these medications. I mean, it's not, you can't just walk away. You have to find a way to have an intervention, if you will, and get away from them. But what becomes too long in your mind to continue filling these meds?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there was this conventional thought among, you know, physicians, and we were kind of taught this a few years ago, that there wasn't really a way for patients to become too dependent on these opioids. And we've seen quite the opposite, right? Just like you said, patients are becoming dependent on these drugs after using them for long periods of time. And so there's new guidelines out that say that, yes, you know, in these situations, we shouldn't be prescribing patients opioids for, you know, extremely long periods of time, and that we should do a good job of, when new patients come in with pain, to give them short prescriptions and have close follow-ups with them. But just like you said, there's patients that have been on these medications for 10 years now, and now they're coming into our offices and saying, hey, some of them are even saying, we know this is wrong, but now I'm dependent on these medications. And that's
Their life revolves around that pill every morning or every afternoon.
Exactly,
they take that pill
exactly
every day. And so if you pull it away from them, you have other problems, right?
I totally agree. And so we now are in this battle as a primary care physician where you're dealing with multiple other medical problems, or diabetes or hypertension, and now, you know, their chronic pain and these pills. How do you manage all of that at the same time? And so the pharmacist will be this devoted person that will devote, you know, 30 minutes just to discussing the pain medications, figuring out a way to safely taper those medications if they're inappropriate, and doing that over a gradual period of time. You can't just take somebody off these medications, you know, in one day. It's a slow process.
No, you have to ramp them down.
That requires a lot of time.
Yeah, you have to ramp them down. I think this is a very smart approach to bring the pharmacist into the conversation. I mean, many times in my life, I've discussed with the pharmacist, how does this work? What can I do? What can I not do? Pharmacists are very well educated and don't get the credit they deserve oftentimes, but they're right there on the front line of medication. So I think this is a brilliant idea.
Well, I appreciate that.
So where do we go from here? How do we get people involved? How do they explore this? We've got a couple of minutes here. How do they get to the point that they can become involved with this program that's being put together by Blue Cross's foundation and take some of this money and try it and see if it works in their community?
Yeah, no, it's a great idea. So, you know, one thing that we are doing, we got the $75,000 pilot to first start doing this at one of the University of Michigan clinics. And we hope that by piloting this in one site at first, we can develop a protocol that can be disseminated to other pharmacists. So other groups around the state, other groups around University of Michigan itself. So we're basically trying to, you know, work out the kinks, figure out the right way that the physicians and the pharmacists should work together to do this, the way that makes sense for patients, a way that makes sense for, you know, policies moving forward. And, you know, we hope that this pilot will provide that information. You know, we are very thankful to the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan Foundation for providing us this grant. And, you know, it seems like they have, you know, other funding available to really kind of explore other evidence-based models. And so, you know, we're hoping that by the time this project is done in a little bit over a year, we'll be able to really kind of disseminate our findings and have other Michigan organizations think about similar models.
Well, I think it's important that you're taking the lead on this, and I certainly salute you for doing so. Dr. Pooja Lagasetti here with us today from the Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation at the University of Michigan. I appreciate your time, and we'll check back in to get an update along the way, Doctor. Greatly appreciate you taking the time to have this conversation.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, back in just a, that's a great innovative approach, by the way. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Steve Gruber Show.
Getting your day started with news from around the state and around the world. Common Sense Radio. This is The Steve Gruber Show.
I would walk 10 miles on my hands and knees. Ain't no doubt about it, baby, it's you I am.
It was a big day at the Supreme Court yesterday as it was handing down decisions, big ones. One in favor of Donald Trump's travel ban from a half a dozen countries. A majority of that travel ban in place now will be in a couple of days. Supreme Court voting 9-0 in favor of the president and the majority of the decision. Also a big win for religious liberty, because Trinity Lutheran Church wins in a big case against the state of Missouri. William Wagner here, president of Salt and Light Global and the Great Lakes Justice Center. William Wagner, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here, Steve. Thank you for having me again.
Both of the, I should mention the big thing, that the dog that did not bark, Justice Kennedy did not announce his resignation. So that did not happen yesterday. Now, it's not required that it happens, but nobody's sure what he's going to do yet. It took Sandra Day O'Connor 2 or 3 days after the end of her term in 2005 before she resigned, but nothing on that front. I should just make a note of that. Now, going forward, William, I'm going to ask you upon your constitutional law hat. This was a big win. I want to start with Trinity Lutheran for a moment, because this was a very big win for religious freedom and equal treatment under the law. At least that's the way I look at it. What is your opinion?
Well, that's exactly what the court did. The court said that, you know, we live in a country that's a pluralist country, and some people are informed by secular ideas. Some people are informed by sacred ideas, and both those have led to good things in the past. And so we shouldn't discriminate against religious people. We shouldn't discriminate against Christian people when we offer public benefits. And so they struck a blow for truth. They struck a blow for freedom and fairness. And so this was just a wonderful surprise, actually, when you start.
Well,
to see...
I think.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say that I think Trinity Lutheran was one of these classic cases where the left is yelling separation of church and state, which means, you know, basically push every, you know, Christian organization into a corner. The stance of separation of church and state so aggressive that the state ended up just flat out violating the church's right to free religious expression and exercise. I mean, that's the way it came down, in fact.
Well, the idea of separation of church and state, it's not in the Constitution, and if it does exist in any way, the way the people that wrote the Constitution understood the First Amendment was that any separation was to mean that the government wasn't supposed to be messing with religion, not that religious people couldn't participate in government programs or have a point of view based on their based on these ancient sacred tenets.
That's correct. And the government wouldn't come along and say, here's the official religion of the United States. It would never do that. But the Establishment Clause has been used to hammer and batter religious organizations for 50 years now, beating them into submission almost. So this was, you cannot understate how big of a win this was for religious freedom.
Well, it is huge. And you just you know, made a point that leads us into that next case with the travel ban, because believe it or not, Steve, the lower court struck down the travel ban that the president had in his executive order to protect the country against terrorism. They struck that down because they said it violated the Establishment Clause. They said the president didn't have a secular reason for the travel ban. Therefore, Mr. President, you cannot protect our nation because you've got to have a secular reason for it. Well, that doctrine was just a part of the longstanding judicial tyranny where people with robes and ink in their pen decide we're going to change the meaning of the Establishment Clause, for example, or some other part of the Constitution to implement our social engineering agenda. And the court, in a very strong rebuke to the lower court, said, hey, judiciary, you're out of control. We're going to kind of rebalance, you know, and we're going to introduce some truth here to the process. And lower courts, you can't tell a president that he has to have a secular reason. And so that's going to be a...
You know, I am concerned, however, that... And that part of the case was decided 9-0. It's unanimous. You're right. However, the court went farther and carved out exceptions to the travel ban, which I don't think the court has I don't believe the court has the right to do. Of course, there's no higher authority. But I don't believe they have a right to adjust or change the plenary powers of the executive branch. Because here's the thing. Make no mistake. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals was not ruling against the President of the United States. They were ruling against Donald Trump as President of the United States. They weren't ruling against the office of the presidency. They were interceding that with Donald Trump, and they were ruling against Donald Trump, and that's not right.
Well, that's exactly correct, but I wouldn't go so far as to say that they have made a final decision yet, because what the court did is the court struck down the lower court's injunction, struck down the lower court's telling the president that he couldn't enforce this against people that had no connection to the United States, that were coming from countries that had a history of terrorism, that were coming into our nation at a time when ISIS was saying we're going to actually use this process to sneak our terrorists in as a Trojan horse. And so the court struck down the lower court's abuse of power against the president there.
Hold on. I want you to say that again. William Wagner here, a constitutional law professor, distinguished professor, former federal prosecutor, former federal judge. Say that again. There was an abuse of power. Is that what you said?
I think that's exactly the message that the Supreme Court was sending to its lower court brothers and sisters, saying, hey, you are out of control. You cannot be an imperial judiciary. You cannot substitute your personal political beliefs for the president, especially in areas like immigration, where the president has exclusive authority, especially when the Congress has passed a statute expressly authorizing the president to do what he did. And mm-hmm. So now the court is going to take up on the merits. They are going to look at the merits of the reason the lower courts put this order in place prohibiting the president. They're going to say, look, the Establishment Clause means that you can't establish a religious government. It doesn't
right.
mean that you have to have a secular purpose for everything you're doing. Although the president...
Now, let me ask you this, because I want to jump on something here. Hold on. William Wagner, I want to jump on something here real quickly before we've got about a minute left, because this plays into something I want to ask you about going on here in Michigan, which is a Choose Life license plate that's now headed to Governor Rick Snyder's desk, a bill creating an optional Choose Life, which has a religious connotation, on a license plate in Michigan, has passed the House 65-43 on the way to the governor's desk. Is this kind of religious decision and so forth of overstepping bounds because you have to have a secular idea or something behind everything you do? Will this give more weight to a Choose Life license plate in so they can have it and not have to fight back against secular groups that'll say, oh, that's horrible. It's a separation of church and state issue and so on and so forth. Real quick.
Well, there are 32 states in the District of Columbia that have Choose Life license plates, including super liberal ones like Massachusetts and Hawaii. this doesn't even have to be a religious issue. Michigan's the only state. If you drive from I-75 all the way down to Florida, we're the only state that doesn't have a choose life license plate option. And you know, what part of the message does the opposition oppose? The part that says choose or the part that says life? You know,
William Wagner had to leave it right there, my friend. So much to get in such a little bit of time. The Great Lakes Justice Center, William Wagner, thank you very much.
You're the best.
Covering Michigan and the world from his bunker below the bridge. Here is Steve Gruber.
All right, welcome back to It 45 After. I'll go ahead and pop those phone lines open if you'd like to join me in the conversation. 888-900-9966, 888-900-9966. A lot to cover today, obviously, with the Supreme Court decisions affecting religious liberty. The Supreme Court decisions saying that Donald Trump was, in fact, right when he said that the Supreme Court would rule in his favor. He was right. Now they'll take up the entire matter in October. Now, there is the chance, because this 90-day period will expire before October, that they could say that it's a moot case and not hear it at all, but I think this case is about a lot more now. It's about a lot more than just this travel ban. It's about how they treat this president, because the Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit, they were aiming at this president, not the presidency or the office of the president, but this person, Donald Trump. That's who they were attacking, because they think that they are entitled to do so. And by a vote of 9-0, the Supreme Court struck down hard, said, no, you're not entitled to do so or do that or behave in this fashion. So it is critical. It was a critical decision, and now we'll find out more coming in October. Again, 888-900-9966 if you are so inclined to join the conversation. The anti-Trump League campaign, which is all connected to this, continues to damage not only American security, but allied operations as well. According to a published report in the Free Beacon, a new wave of leaks targeting the Trump administration has actively endangered ongoing intelligence and military operations being conducted by the United States and its allies, sparking anger and concern inside and outside of the White House. The classified leaks, which are being handed to sympathetic journalists by former Obama administration officials who left the government, and by holdovers that some would call the deep state still serving in the Trump administration, have damaged a number of ongoing operations, ranging from American efforts to prevent Russian infiltration to the United States to Israeli efforts against ISIS. A recent Washington Post story disclosed classified secrets is part of a larger story about the Obama administration's cyber efforts against Russia. It came just days after a New York Times story, which revealed details of a secret Israeli cyber operation that Donald Trump is said to have leaked to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The sensitivity of the material being leaked has heightened criticism both of the former Obama administration officials, who are suspected of unveiling these secrets, and of the Trump administration for its seeming inability to stem the disclosures. You've got these massive, you're hemorrhaging information. You're putting everybody at danger. And the people that are doing it are wrong and should be prosecuted. But the Trump administration, so far, seemingly unable to get it under control. Now, I think they've put a tourniquet on it and doing their best to cinch it down. But this puts us all at risk. Loose lips sink ships, right? And so that's an area of grave concern, to say the least. And as if you don't have enough to worry about, here's something else for you to concern yourself with this Tuesday. A small earthquake has struck Yellowstone National Park again, part of a swarm that has been hitting the area recently. The quake centered near West Yellowstone. also felt by people as far away as Gardner and Bozeman. Yellowstone gets about 1,500 to 2,000 earthquakes every year. About half of those come in earthquake swarms. Lots of earthquakes in a small area over a short period of time is called a swarm. So this activity isn't completely abnormal. But the most recent quake was the largest in the current swarm. It's the largest in the area since 2014, when a 4.8 magnitude hit the area. And the concern that some scientists have is that, well, the Yellowstone's getting ready to do something more substantial. We would certainly hope not. It's a super volcano. The swarm is the effect of normal tectonic stress on the Earth's crust. As of last Friday, University of Utah seismologists weren't seeing anything volcanic in nature yet. Yellowstone National Park, home to the largest volcano, and the site of the largest and most diverse collection of natural thermal features in the world. Hot springs and geysers, tectonic shifting plates. And the scientists say, unfortunately, it is impossible to predict when this current earthquake storm will end. They could turn off in a heartbeat, or they could go on for months, and they could get much worse. Some people reporting that if you feel an earthquake in that part of the country, please call the United States Geological Survey. They have a thing there called Did You Feel It? Did you feel it? All right, let's go to Critch. Chris on Richland. Chris, how are you?
Good. Yeah, that earthquake swarm does scare me a little bit. We're right in the fallout area. If anything bad happens, short of the earthquake.
What's the worst thing that happened? Half the country disappears. The rest of us are under 10 feet of ash. No big deal. What else is on your mind? Yep.
So I want to talk about that deep state leaking stuff. And, you know, so I've always paid attention to politics and the goings on. But the one thing I noticed as of late is that starting in under W, we really haven't prosecuted any of these alleged leakers. And you know, a lot of these guys, you have a, you know, like Manning, you have a really strong case for treason. And that he should have been prosecuted under treason. But the longer we go and not prosecute these people, the more it becomes entrenched that it's okay to just go ahead and grab that document and give it to somebody else like that.
And you're right, Chris. It's not okay. We've got to put an end to it. It's not okay, Chris. I greatly appreciate you calling today. It's 52 after on the Steve Gruber Show.